This is the first episode in a three-part series. This episode briefly mentions alleged intimate partner violence and alleged sexual assault. All parties discussed are assumed innocent unless proven guilty in a court of law. This is the Fall Line. Back in August of 1976, in the small city of Lewiston, Idaho, a young wife and mother disappeared. 24-year-old Patricia Patty Otto, born Patricia O'Malley, was last seen by her estranged husband, Ralph Otto, 42. Things had been tense at the Otto home. According to family reports, Ralph's statements to police, and his own medical records, he was an alcoholic, and he'd sought both in- and outpatient treatment. That spring, Patty had moved out for a while. They'd filed for divorce, but she'd eventually returned. Part of Ralph's regimen included a high dose of Valium to help control alcohol withdrawal symptoms. Patty's return home hinged on Ralph's continued sobriety, but by that August, multiple sources note that Ralph was drinking again, and he and Patty were in a bad place. The Lewiston Tribune reported that on the night of August 31st, Patty attended a night class. To do so, she'd left her young daughters, Natalie, who was 5, and Dallas, who was 3, with her parents. That was easy enough, because they lived nearby. When her secretarial class was over, she'd stopped at her parents' house to visit for a little while. Then she retrieved her sleeping girls, and she returned to the Otto residence. After Patty brought the girls home, she had an argument with Ralph. Everyone agreed then, agrees still, on that much of the story. Ralph said so in his later statements to police, and his supporters agreed that it was likely, given their pattern. What came next, though, has been the source of a nearly 50-year mystery. Ralph and some other family members alleged that after the fight, Patty walked out of the residence for the last time. She was finally ready to leave Ralph for good. They claimed that she'd been threatening to do so for years. Patty's family, though, they disagreed. They said she'd never leave her children. They pointed to some troubling evidence. For instance, police files indicate that her car was still at the family home. And eventually, per the Lewiston Tribune, her wedding rings were found there too, in one of Ralph's suit pockets. Per both police records and archival media, her disappearance was viewed as suspicious. And Ralph? He was considered a person of interest pretty much from the start. In fact, according to a 2014 article from the Lewiston Tribune, then recently retired Lewiston Police Captain Tom Green described Ralph Otto as, quote, the primary suspect. He told the paper, quote, there was no indication anybody else was involved. The Tribune does note, though, that Otto was never formally charged in Patty's disappearance or her death. In regard to the 1976 investigation, it wasn't all so cut and dry. As we said, Ralph had been named as a suspect by police and in the media. That has not changed over the years. But there was a lack of evidence. And then there were a few possible clues that muddled the investigation and made it difficult to discover what, if anything, had happened that night. And then, within a few years of Patty's disappearance, Ralph Otto passed away of natural causes. That avenue of investigation was lost. And then there was another bizarre twist. Between the night of Patty's disappearance and the time of his death, Ralph had been arrested for and convicted of a murder-for-hire plot involving an investigator associated with his wife's case. But that conviction was overturned by the Idaho Supreme Court, and he was freed within a few years. Just 2 years after Patty's August 1976 disappearance, and about 130 miles away, the partial skeletal remains of a woman were found in Elgin, Oregon. Local and state authorities believed that she was young and likely in the late stages of pregnancy. Though she was compared to a number of missing women, including Patty Otto, all were excluded or they couldn't be ruled in or out. That was due to a lack of information on one side or another. There have been issues with records, and with much, much more. Some think this unidentified woman, known as the Findlay Creek Jane Doe, is Patty Otto. They believed she was ruled out in error, and they found evidence they believe is worth a serious effort at comparison by medico-legal professionals. But even more than that, they're working to resolve both cases, the disappearance of Patty and the identity of Findlay Creek Jane Doe. Even if she isn't Patty, these advocates understand that the cases, they're now intertwined. This is a story of many women. Patty Otto, who disappeared in 1976. Suzanne Timms, her youngest daughter, who used to be known as Dallas Otto. She's been investigating her mother's disappearance for years. Natalie, Patty's eldest, who was doing her own investigation until her death in 2006. The Findlay Creek Jane Doe, whose remains were discovered in 1978. An Oregon local, Mel Jetterberg, who learned about the unidentified woman in her own small town and who wanted to help. And now, two victim advocates, Shayna and Tates of Light the Way, who are helping them pull together all those strings. It's not a simple series of events to unravel, but when two cases go cold, 2 years and hundreds of miles apart, with so many knots in their threads, we didn't expect it would be.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
We first became aware of Suzanne Timms, formerly Dallas Otto, through TikTok. As we said, she's Patty's youngest daughter. The story of her name change is something that she'll get to a little later in these episodes. When we found her for the first time, it was because she was talking about her mother. For months, she'd been posting videos under the account Patty's Voice. In the vein of other family member advocates like Sarah Turney and Julie Murray, Suzanne had decided to try and get Patty's story out to the wider public. And it worked. We saw her in the algorithm. It did not start out that way for Suzanne. For a long time, she'd thought her mother ran away. That's not surprising. She was only three in 1976, and that's the story she was told. She had some memories that disturbed her, but she says those were dismissed as dreams. And she mostly believed that assurance until she was a teenager. That's when she and her older sister Natalie, they got access to the police files. When Suzanne grew up, she started asking her own questions. And now, years later, she's trying to reach as many people as she can via social media about Patty. But she's not just online to discuss her mother's case and what might have been missed or stalled. She's there to talk about another woman too, Findlay Creek Jane Doe. And when we discovered what had happened in the case, mostly due to 20th century procedural issues, we wanted to bring you both stories. Because, as we said, they're intertwined, and they both need to be solved. To tell you the stories, we need to begin in Idaho, with Patty, and with Ralph. We spoke with Suzanne in multiple interviews to find out more about her mother, her family, and how her understanding of Patty's disappearance has changed over the years. It's why she began her fight. It's why she needs help to identify Findlay Creek Jane Doe. We asked Suzanne to start with Ralph and Patty's childhoods, and then explain how they met. Her parents were not contemporaries. In fact, they grew up in entirely different generations.
So my father grew up in the Depression during the 30s, and his parents were both married very young. My grandma was 14 years old, grandpa was 18, and they had the four children. So they had Jerry and Ralph, Marcy and Ray. In 1952, while they were at a family gathering, the oldest, Jerry, and his wife were out swimming in the water with their mother, and the wife went under. She got caught in a little eddy, and Jerry went to grab her and his mother was also being pulled in, and he was able to grab her and push her out of the eddy as grandma got pulled in, grabbed her and pulled her out, and Jerry went under. So Jerry drowned in front of his family. They didn't find him till the following day. He was only 21 years old at the time. He had just had an 18-month-old baby. It was traumatic for the family. My grandmother did not handle it well. She did not have, I guess, the support that she needed from her family. She kind of turned to alcohol. And then 2 years after that, my 39-year-old grandfather died in the doctor's office of a cardiac arrest. So here, grandma's not coping well with losing Jerry and then loses her husband. So my father at the time is like a 16-year-old kid, and he feels pressured that he needs to also be the man of the house now because the oldest brother has died and his father's died. So my dad is trying to work and support the family. And I think that's where my father's drinking problem started, right at a really young age.
Some of these were stories that Suzanne grew up hearing, but others she didn't really understand until much later, until she was living with her dad's sister Marcy and her uncle Bud, or even when she began her own research. She tells us that when she and Natalie got copies of all those police files, which include 1,000 or so pages of reports, interviews, and court documents, it painted a more complete picture of her father than she'd ever really had before. One thing Suzanne told us was that her father was involved in many romantic relationships throughout his life, whether or not he was married at the time. And she says that he did what he wanted, whether or not it was necessarily legal.
So my dad was kind of an old soul, I think, and he always thought that he was like this outlaw, and he liked to do interesting things like drag racing, and he would learn how to rebuild these old cars, and they would soup them up. He found out that he could make a lot of money doing this mechanic work as a side job, and so he was known to have money because, you know, think of it, at 16 years old, he's purchasing his parents' home for like $5,000, you know, back in that time. He's buying a home, and he liked to show off that he had money. He liked to drink and party, and he would have parties at the house. They would have music. It felt like he was born in the wrong era because he wanted to be this outlaw cowboy, this, I don't know, almost like a gangster kind of personality, that he just wanted to be known as having money and being wealthy and living on the edge. He would brag about things like stealing things, which was really strange to me, because if you have money, why are you going to brag about stealing? But it was an adrenaline rush to him to steal things.
Did you get the sense that he wanted to be a little notorious?
Yes, a bad boy, a notorious bad boy. He wanted that. I don't know why, but he wanted that vibe. If he wanted to do something wild and crazy, Ralph was going to be the one to do it.
It was very different for Patty O'Malley. If Ralph had chaos, she had structure. That's what her friends and sisters have told Suzanne.
And then my mom, on the other hand, she grows up in a very strict Catholic home. For fun, she's out babysitting, right? She's babysitting at 16. She's not doing the things that he's doing at 16. He's married and throwing wild parties at his house. My mother, a very different family. She was born in the 50s, and her father was a firefighter. Her mother worked at the mill. They had three girls. Vicky was the oldest. My mother, Patty, was in the middle. And then Alice is the youngest daughter. And then they had Tommy. So there's four children as well. But different family dynamics. They actually lived just up the street from Ralph and Joy. So my dad and his first wife, they lived up the street. When Dad divorced Joy in 1966, he had moved in another woman who he was helping her out.
That can get a little confusing if you don't know the story well. What Suzanne just explained was that when her dad Ralph was around 30, he and his first wife Joy, they divorced. After that, one of his former girlfriends, Bonnie, she moved into the house for a little while. Suzanne says that it was not a romantic situation. Bonnie just needed somewhere to stay for a while to get back on her feet. She was a single mother to five children, and Ralph was generous. He actually continued to help Bonnie support her children long after she moved out. But while she was living there, they needed some help with the kids. Patty, then a teenager, she was a known babysitter in the neighborhood.
So these children, needed a babysitter, and they would call Patty to come babysit while Dad took Bonnie out on the town, and they spent time together. And that's how my father met my mother. He was babysitting when Bonnie moved out in 1968. So when my dad started having her clean the house, he had a Thunderbird car and he would let her drive the car. So I think my mom became a little interested in that feeling of, oh, look at this, I've got a car. He would buy her expensive clothing. He would spoil her with things like that.
Soon it developed into a romantic relationship. We're told that Ralph was popular with women. The police files contain multiple interviews that state he was carrying on long-term affairs that allegedly included relationships with the wives and girlfriends of both friends and relatives. And on another very serious note, there's also record of a police interview conducted after Patty's disappearance that mentions an alleged violent sexual assault. This assault allegedly took place years prior, and it was not reported to law enforcement until that interview. We won't go into any more detail to protect the privacy of the survivor, but according to the survivor, that information was not shared with friends or family. It's not something Patty would have any knowledge of. She knew Ralph as a relatively wealthy man from the neighborhood, someone who was nice to her. We can't verify precisely how old Patty was when the nature of their relationship changed, but we know that she was only 18 when they finally married.
She was 18. Dad was 32, 34. So they got married in 1970 and had my sister in 71 and me in 73.
What did her parents think of your dad?
So Patty's oldest sibling had wanted to get married right out of high school, and Grandma and Grandpa pushed back on that. They did not want them to get married. They felt they were too young. They wanted them to wait. And Aunt Vicky ran off and married Uncle Ron. They eloped. So because of that, when Patty brings in this much older man and starts saying, I'm going to move in with him, we're going to get married, they did not push back because they had saw what happened with Aunt Vicky, which Aunt Vicky's turned out just fine. Her and Uncle Ron were married for, I swear, 50, 60 years, and he recently passed. They did not approve at all, but they didn't push back because they did not want to lose their daughter or strain the relationship like they did with Aunt Vicky. They were concerned, obviously, that this much older man who was divorced, however, he's offering to give her this lifestyle that it sounded like you're going to be well taken care of. You know, you're not going to have to work. You're not going to have to do these things. You can be a stay-at-home mom and take care of your two children. So they tried to be supportive of it, but that relationship was very strained at times. My dad had times where he punched people. He showed up and kicked one of them in the groin. I mean, he was just always aggressive and I guess trying to fight and stand his ground in a physical way. So it was not a great relationship. They just tried to make the best of it because they loved their daughter and wanted to be part of their lives and our lives. They didn't want us to be pulled away from them.
At least one of those altercations is mentioned in the police files we read concerning Patty's disappearance. An uncle of Suzanne's advised law enforcement that he was physically attacked by Ralph. We don't have much information concerning the early days of their marriage and how smoothly it went, but Suzanne did hear a story later from another relative that indicated that her father might not have been faithful. It was about the day that her sister Natalie was born.
While my mom is in labor, they're rushing to the hospital, and my dad says to make sure, or my mom tells my dad, grab me some clothes and grab me some extra shoes. He gave her the shoes of another woman. And I hear this because what happened is one of her cousins is in labor at the same time. And I interviewed that cousin all these years later. And she was like, I will never forget that Ralph brings in the clothes and the shoes belong to another woman, which meant he had the clothing of another woman in his car or at the house. And she was furious.
Because she was so young when Patty disappeared, it's hard for Suzanne to get a clear picture of what their family life, all four of them together, what it might have been like. She's tried to search for context clues, but it hasn't been easy. She told us that she's examined just about everything she can get her hands on to try and understand what kind of woman her mother was and how she related to her children, what their day-to-day life was like.
So again, there's two different stories that I can tell you. Growing up, I thought she never wanted to be a mother and that she was the worst parent in the whole world because she abandoned me. So I grew up with this very twisted sense of this woman who I'm like, she was just terrible. She came in as a gold digger and up and left when she didn't get her way. She just left us and abandoned us. As I go into the investigation and I start talking to her high school friends, to people who are willing to talk to me, I hear that at 16, she's babysitting five children because she loves children. Wait a minute, she liked babysitting. Why didn't she like being a mother? That was all false. She doted on us. Something that I recognized recently was I'm going through our pictures and Natalie and I have professional photography pictures done. I swear every 3 to 6 months. And I'm picturing in those pictures, I see my little self, my little two-year-old self, all dolled up and smiling with this little pink cape on or my hair done. She's doing that every 3 to 6 months. She's dressing us up. She's fixing my hair. She's taking me in. She's having these done. How many times did I do that with my own children, right? It's like, I don't have time for that, let alone it's the money that's involved in it, the time and effort. And I'm thinking that doesn't fit the picture of a woman that doesn't want to be a mother. She was so proud of us and wanted to show us off and always made a point of investing time and effort and money into us. So that was interesting that I'm like, why, how did I believe this stuff, knowing that all this evidence out there exists, but as a child, you don't see that.
Those pictures have been one of her clues, that and Patty's obvious love for children. But until Suzanne was much older, she wasn't really able to ask many questions about Patty's personality. When she was young, she didn't understand. She thought the people around her simply didn't like Patty. Suzanne only found out later, after August 76, it had been made a rule that no one was to discuss Patty with the children. That's what she's been told in retrospect, of course. We can't get Ralph's side of the story. But what she could have learned from Patty's family back then was how Patty felt about being a mother. It's still something that Suzanne wonders about.
They were not allowed to say anything, although at the time we didn't know that. In my mind, they forgot about Patty. I really thought that they had forgotten that they had a daughter because it had been so long and they were so old, they must have just forgotten that Patty existed because she's not mentioned. She's not celebrated. We don't have a party for Patty on her birthday or for Mother's Day. There's no, you want to write a card for your mom. And if she comes home, nothing like that. And so I thought, oh, if I bring it up, and grandma and grandpa don't remember her, I don't want to make them feel bad because there are old people who don't remember her. It's not like they're 110 years old. They're in their 60s, but I'm just a little kid who thinks, obviously, they've forgotten. There's no pictures of her anywhere. They don't talk about her. They don't tell me stories about her.
But we do know something of Patty's life when Suzanne was small, even though her children's memories can't provide it. Between official records and past and present interviews with family and friends, a story does take shape of a young woman who loved her family, but who was increasingly frustrated with her life, not with her children, but with her marriage. According to the records compiled by both police and Suzanne, Ralph had sought out advice from his doctor as early as 1973 regarding both alcoholism and depression. These issues were discussed publicly when he filed for divorce from Patty after her disappearance, which is why we can share them here. According to those records, Patty had been an active participant in various stages of Ralph's treatment plans. Still, issues seemed to escalate. Verbal arguments continued, as did concerns regarding Ralph's physical and emotional health, and per police interviews, whether he was taking his medication as prescribed. In a number of police interviews, witnesses alleged Patty had reported at least two instances of intimate partner violence in the period between 1973 and 1976. These are secondhand accounts police were not able to verify, But one interviewee said Patty alleged she'd been shoved down and choked at least once. Patty never filed a police report, but law enforcement did make note of these witness statements. A police report summarizing a conversation with Ralph, though not a direct transcript of his own words, indicated that he had struck a former partner. In his own taped and transcribed police interviews, he discussed physical altercations with other men at length.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
A consistent thread of conflict that ran through Ralph and Patty's marriage was infidelity. It's something you heard Suzanne mention when she told the story of the day her sister Natalie was born. The files she shared with us contained mention of numerous alleged and confirmed, by at least one person involved, affairs involving Ralph Otto. It was something that Patty was upset about. Per witnesses, she mentioned the affairs more than once. But Ralph, he was primarily concerned with the single relationship we know that Patty had, one she was briefly involved in when they were legally separated in the spring of 1976. According to notes Suzanne summarized from the family, it appears Patty had been living with her younger sister since around December 1975. That winter and following spring had been a particularly intense period. Ralph was hospitalized, and then he received a DWI in January, and then probation. In March, he entered rehab. Soon after, it's noted, Patty actually got her own apartment. According to Suzanne, the couple had also filed for divorce. This is when she had a brief relationship with a man named Randy. We'll stick to first names to protect his privacy. Randy is close to Patty's age, and he's someone she'd known, though not well, for pretty much her whole life. They'd spent time together as children, but they hadn't been close. Back in 1976, Randy was a young widower. He and Patty had happened to reconnect after divorce papers had been filed, and according to police records and just about everyone law enforcement spoke to, Ralph Otto was extremely unhappy about this development. A few years ago, Suzanne, she found Randy, and he was happy to speak with us about his brief relationship with Patty, his impression of her life, and his understanding of Ralph's reaction to the entire situation.
I'm going to give you a little background here for a minute. I was married in the spring of 70, or fall of 75. And in the spring of 75, we had a car accident. My wife was killed.
Randy was devastated, and he says that he spent most of the next year in a blur, either working or playing in his country band at small local clubs, trying to fill his time, trying to fight against grief.
I was drinking pretty heavy for about a year, and I was working, I had like three jobs. I was working days building houses and then playing three or four nights a week in nightclubs. And so Patty came in one night to one of the nightclubs by where she lived. It's called Vans Club, where I was playing. And we kind of reconnected there.
Was Patty a music fan?
You know, she was. She was very fun. I mean, she was more than a music fan. I mean, she was just fun. She always had a really beautiful smile. I mean, she was just fun. She was fun to talk to. She was fun to look at and just be around.
Randy alleges that Patty told him that Ralph had been following her and keeping up with her activities. Again, we don't have verification of this, but it's his memory of how events unfolded at the time. He said she worried about what would happen if Ralph showed up when they were on a date.
She said one time, what would I do if Ralph showed up? And I, defend myself.
By all accounts, Randy and Patty had a short but happy relationship. And when he spoke to Suzanne, he was able to tell her a little more about her mother.
He's told me such kind things about my mom, how incredibly beautiful she was, how kind she was, how much she adored us. He would have easily, if they were to continue a relationship, he would have had no problem taking me and Natalie on as his stepkids. He was ready to have a family. His wife had just been killed in an accident. So he was a widow, 24, just a widow. And he's like, your mom just changed her mind. It was like right before Mother's Day and she wanted to go home and she just went back to be with Ralph.
Based on the information Natalie and Suzanne compiled, that decision was based on recommendations for Ralph's treatment. Here's what Suzanne put together, based on records and family recollection.
He was trying to get off of the alcohol. So Patty had left that spring, right? In 1976, she said, I'm done. I'm not doing this. You're a raging alcoholic and I'm not. The alcohol fuels aggression and there had been incidents. So she packed up and left, got her own place, and he went to inpatient treatment for 2 months. I believe he was in inpatient treatment. When he came out, the therapist insisted that my mother do her part as a wife and help with his sobriety by coming home. So she did her wifely duties to help him be sober, and he was immediately drinking. By June, July, he got another DUI. That's how quickly that progressed.
Although Patty's relationship with Randy was over at this point, Randy confirms it. Ralph had made threats against his life that police considered serious. Those records are contained within their official files. In fact, it appears that for a period after Patty's disappearance, Randy left town for his own safety because Ralph had made verbal threats against his life. To explain this, we need to move forward in time just a little after Patty's disappearance so you can understand what Randy knew and what he didn't know. The earliest police records we have indicate that witnesses knew Ralph was looking for Randy as early as the 1st of September, 1976. A bartender at the club where Randy's band played reported that Ralph had come in. He inquired where he could find Randy. When the bartender asked why, he told police that Ralph, quote, pulled up his shirt and stuck in his pants at the waistline was a revolver. When recounting the story to police, Ralph reportedly said, quote, Randy was going to be a dead man. The hate I have in my guts for him, I just can't explain. If I had just 5 minutes with him, you wouldn't have to worry about him anymore or my wife. The officer who wrote the report summary, Captain Dwayne Ayler, noted, quote, at this time when Ralph was talking to me, he had his hands in a clenched position. Further, police interview transcripts have direct quotes from Ralph stating several times, in his own words, that he wanted to kill Randy. At that point, September 1976, Randy says it had been months since he'd even seen Patty. He happened to live near a Lewiston police officer, Tom Saline, who verified that no women had been seen coming or going from Randy's apartment. And we know that Patty no longer had her apartment either. She'd returned to the family home back in May. Randy told police that not only had he not seen Patty, they'd had no contact at all. In fact, he didn't even know that Patty had gone missing, not until Lewiston law enforcement showed up at his door in early September. They wanted to ask him about Patty, but it was obvious that Randy, he hadn't run off with her, he was still at home, and they had a more immediate concern, his safety. Here's what Randy recalls.
When the detective came and talked to me and informed me that he was going to try to kill me, that he said, you can't trust anything he's doing because he's drinking and he's taking drugs. And I don't know what drugs he was taking, but he said he was pretty crazy.
Per police files, Randy was advised to leave town for a while for his own safety. He did, but even when he returned, Randy said there were still concerns. When his band played shows, he was a potential target.
They put an off-duty policeman at the door for a while until he went to jail because we played various places. And so they would put an off-duty policeman at the door So, because when you're on stage and the lights are in your eyes, you can't see nothing. And so they didn't want me to be shot off stage. And so they would have a policeman at the door in case he came in. And I talked to the policeman. I said, "Man, can't you arrest people if they threaten people like that?" He said, "No, you can't arrest them until they try." And I said, "Well, that's come."
But that never did come. Ralph Otto did not hurt Randy. The events that unfolded before and after Patty's disappearance, perhaps they played a part, and we'll go through all of those. But something that Randy remembers from the last time that he saw Patty is perhaps more important than he could have ever known. It was around May of 1976, just before she returned home.
She asked me what I'd do if Ralph showed up, and I said, "Well, I guess we'd be in a fight." At that point, I thought she was getting a divorce. And she was wearing that blouse with the little red hearts or ducks or whatever it is on it. She was wearing that.
The blouse is what stuck in his memory. And that's interesting for two reasons. On the night she disappeared, Patricia Otto was wearing that same shirt, a white sleeveless top with tiny red print, along with red pants. Randy didn't know that, of course, and he wouldn't know that 2 years later, 2 hours away, the skeletal remains of a woman would be discovered wearing the remnants of clothing that seemed strikingly similar, a white sleeveless blouse with a tiny red print and red pants. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Patricia Otto, please call Captain Jeff Clone at the Lewiston Police Department at 208-746-0171. Next time on The Fall Line, we begin with the night of Patty Otto's disappearance and what came in the days after, Ralph Otto's arrest and conviction for a different crime, and what happened to Natalie and Suzanne after their mother's disappearance, and what Suzanne and her family have gone through in the years since as she's attempted to investigate her own mother's disappearance. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independent podcast, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, and pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And please take a moment to rate and review our show on your podcast app of choice. My book, Lay Them to Rest, which covers years of my life working on a Jane Doe case and the world of forensic scientists who resolve unidentified persons cases, is out everywhere as hardcover, ebook, and audiobook, read by me. You can order it anywhere you get books and through your local library. Find out more in the link in our show notes. If you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon or Apple Premium. 100% of our Patreon and Apple Premium earnings are supporting our Family Therapy Fund and actively paying for therapy for families who've appeared on the show. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. If you prefer Apple Premium, you can subscribe there as well. On Patreon, we also post occasional giveaways, updates, and blogs, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just $1. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove, produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Liz Lipka.